You're listening to Slow Theology, Simple Faith for Chaotic Times, with AJ Swoboda and Nijay Gupta. Welcome back. Nijay here with AJ. And lately, we've been thinking a lot about prayer. And as we journey through the kind of key issues related to the formation of our faith, we thought it'd be helpful to do a series of episodes on the Lord's Prayer. I think this is so important, AJ, because I think when I'm going through seasons of doubt or distance from God, it's actually the hardest time for me to pray, but it's the time that's most important for me to be turning towards God, to be bringing lament and complaint and questions and tears to God. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, AJ. I've always struggled with prayer. Mm-hmm. It's always been one of the hardest parts of my Christian life. Bible reading, I ace Bible reading, okay? I'm a Bible scholar. It's literally my day job. Mm-hmm. Studying the Bible, memorizing the Bible, worship, all of that. You know, that's, I can do that. Prayer is really, really difficult for me. I feel like I'm talking to myself. I feel like my prayers are inarticulate. I feel like they're very inconsistent. So about 10 years ago, a publisher came to me and they said, if you could write on any topic in the Bible that's going to help churches, what would you want to write on, any biblical text? And I chose the Lord's Prayer. And I spent 3 to 4 years doing a deep dive into the Lord's Prayer. It's a short set of verses, but I read hundreds and hundreds of pages of scholarship from the ancient world to today. And I became so captivated with the Lord's Prayer because this is, you'll find, I hope you'll find this amazing, AJ, as much as I do. It is the most memorized, most recited, and most studied piece of literature in all of history, in all of the world.
Wow.
Any religion, any nation, any language, it's the most studied piece of literature.
Wild.
Even within the Bible, it's the most studied piece of literature. And so from day one, the church latched on to the Lord's Prayer as an absolute essential resource for the Christian life. One of my passions is Christian catechesis, bringing back, making Christian catechesis great again. This was a practice of the early church. And I discovered this in a class in seminary called the Educational Ministry of the Church, that the ancient church had a really robust educational training program for would-be Christians and Christians. It involved three main pieces of Scripture and doctrine. Catechumens would study the Ten Commandments to focus on morality, behavior. They would study the Apostles' Creed, which we've actually done a series called Slow Creed, to focus on doctrine. And they would study the Lord's Prayer to focus on spirituality and prayer. And in fact, there are a number of catechisms that are partially based on the Lord's Prayer, things like Heidelberg Catechism, Luther's Catechism, Westminster Catechism.
Yep.
So the Lord's Prayer, for being short, is really, 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 really powerful. And I'll just tell you one story that I remember. I don't remember a whole lot of things from the year of my conversion back when I was 16, but I do remember right around that time that I was a new believer, just learning about the Bible, just learning about Christianity. And my school went on a, this is going to sound really nerdy, Latin club slash art club trip to Italy.
That's nerdy. That's very nerdy.
So I was in the Latin club, but if you couldn't tell which one I was in. So Latin club, and we went, there's about maybe 15 of us with our Latin teacher, and we went, and our art teacher. And we went to Italy, and we had a chance to go to the Vatican. It's the first time I'd ever been to the Vatican. And I remember standing outside the Vatican, and my teacher, who was a Christian, it's a public school, she gathered together a few students that she knew were Christians, and we prayed the Lord's Prayer.
Wow.
in front of the Vatican. And I remember that, it was almost 30 years later, as just a powerful spiritual experience for me. And it kind of came full circle when I wrote this book. What's your experience like with the Lord's Prayer? Is it as captivating to you as it is to me?
Yeah, I'm really glad we're having this conversation. Ironically, as a self disclosure, as a charismatic, as somebody who has a really high view of sort of the spontaneous, on the spot sort of approach towards Christian spirituality, when in our world, we don't have catechesis. Pentecostals, charismatics, we don't have catechesis. Our adrenal gland is basically our catechism. We have a really very, very high view of experience, and probably too high a view of experience. And as a result, I've been in prayer meetings, man, where it just never ends. I mean, it's constant, never. And the lingering impression that puts on me is this sense that true prayer demands length, and that true prayer requires a lot of time. I remember years ago hearing this lecture that Frederick Dale Brunner did, who is a New Testament scholar. He wrote his commentary on Matthew. He was doing some teaching in Portland, and it was the first time I ever heard somebody really teach on this. That actually much of what Jesus taught about prayer goes against pretty much everything I'm taught in my charismatic world, which is Jesus actually commands us not to bring many words in prayer.
Yeah.
And that there is a structure for prayer that Jesus gives. It's extraordinarily simple. Mm-hmm. It's framed, it's clear, and there's room for spontaneity, but it's a structure. There's a structure to it.
Yeah.
So not many words and a structure. And that goes against a lot of sort of the charismatic spirituality that I find myself in. And I got to say, it's extraordinarily refreshing because I am tired of living under the presumption of shame because I don't say enough to God. Mm. And this, actually, this, the Lord's Prayer, it's like Moses confronting my Pharaoh of self-talk that I'm a failure and I'm lazy and a lazy servant and I'm not good at prayer. I love reading this because it invites me to keep it short, terse, clear, and intentional. So in a way, this it's a liberating, I mean, it's so liberating for people like me. I'm curious, you spent years researching this section, and specifically we're going to focus on Matthew 6 in this series, but obviously Luke records the same, but kind of abbreviated version of the Lord's Prayer. I mean, where did this, in your research, where did this prayer actually come from?
Great question. And knowing the background is so crucial to kind of understanding what it is that Jesus was offering his disciples. Because what's funny is I don't know very many Christians today, when they first become Christian, they actually ask their pastor, how do you pray? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because you just assume, you just start talking to God, you just, pick up the phone, start talking. Yet the disciples were really, in Luke's version, the disciples were really adamant, hey, we need to know how we should pray. Mm-hmm. You need to teach us your way. And then in Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount is very methodical with, hey, these are the ways that you follow me. Mm. But I want to pick up on what you said, because in the Greco-Roman world, which, the Roman world is where early Christianity came into being, prayer was an attempt to get the attention of a deity. Mm. So you would work really hard using spells, very specific wording. You had to be sometimes in the right place. Mm-hmm. You had to make a sacrifice, make an oath. So you had to strain and struggle. There were religions of the time where you'd have to cut yourself. You'd have to take certain drugs. You'd have to appear before a divination expert. And Jesus just makes it real simple, just like what you were saying. He's like, you don't have to use special words.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You don't have to use special techniques. So think about it this way, AJ. There are people in our lives that we're kind of stressed out about talking to. Imagine if you got a ticket for running a red light, you have to appear before a judge. Mm. You're going to think very carefully about the words that you use when you're talking to an authority like a judge.
Right,
right. Right? You're not going to be like, hey, bro, let me off the hook, dude. Like, you're not going to do that. There's a certain amount of professional speech, and you're worried about getting in more trouble. That's the way that many people in the ancient world viewed the deities, is that you can't speak casually. You have to be really concerned with the words you're using.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jesus wasn't saying treat God like he's your bro.
Right.
But when I think about people that I can be myself with, right, there's a really small circle.
Yeah.
Where there's people I can, when they say, how are you? Like, AJ, when you are talking to me on the phone, you call me every once in a while, maybe once a week, and we check in. When you ask me how I'm doing,
you're real.
I tell you how I'm doing. But when most people ask me how I'm doing, I say, I'm fine. How are you? And that's kind of the way it is in a lot of Greco-Roman religion, is there's a lot of distance and posturing and decorum. But Jesus, as you said, his prayer is right to the point. It's very honest. It's very personal. But one thing I find really interesting, and this has changed how I pray, is the Lord's Prayer in many ways builds off of Israel's most famous prayer from the Old Testament, the Shema, from Deuteronomy. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God. Here's what I find fascinating, because I've known that for a long time, but it really occurred to me. When you read Deuteronomy 6, it doesn't strike you as a prayer. It's a confession. Because you're not saying, hear, O God. You're saying, hear, O Israel. And then you're not saying, dear God, I want this. You're saying, the Lord is one. And then it's not saying, I love you, Lord. It's saying, you shall love the Lord your God. So in prayer, Israel is in the presence of God, but also talking to one another. And first and foremost, it's about making sure you understand who you're talking to.
Nietzsche, isn't it also true? I mean, I've read this in a couple places. It's in a book that I've got coming out, so I really hope it's true. But
I'll let you know.
But yeah, it was really common in the ancient world for gods to go unnamed. When Paul Wright goes into that ancient city, comes across the site of to the unknown God, largely because the gods didn't actually want people to be able to call on them. And that sometimes these gods would remain anonymous because they didn't want to be doxxed. They didn't want people to be able to call on them. And when we look here at this prayer multiple times, Jesus gives us the name of the Father. Father, Father, Father,
yeah,
Father.
Yeah.
Is this reveal? What does Jesus say, right? In John, oh, is it 17? Father, I've come to reveal your name to the world, to the disciples. Is there some truth to that?
You know, there's a mix. You know, some gods really want to be known and named in the same way that a politician, right, wants everyone to know their name. But what they don't want it to be is an over familiarity or comfort that they feel that with that person or that name.
Right.
But then there are other gods that probably want to seem more mysterious. So there were these things called the mystery religions. And the whole point of these mystery religions is it wasn't for the masses. It was for the privileged few. You pay a little money, you go to this dark cave, you get drunk, you get high, and you can commune with this God, but there's going to be some hoops you have to jump through to actually make the connection, right?
Yep.
And here, Jesus is saying you can be anywhere. And when he says, go into your closet, he doesn't mean Christians should pray privately. I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions of prayer in the modern evangelical world. When Jesus says, go into your closet and close the door, he's not saying pray individually. He's saying, don't pray as a way of showing off how religious you are.
Right.
Imagine if I went, okay, I'm going to go on Instagram Live and I'm going to pray prayers, come pray with me, but I'm really just doing it for the appearance of spirituality. That's what Jesus condemns.
Yeah.
But Jesus says, okay, I'm going to give you a real basic, simple way to pray, and pray with me. But like you said, he makes it really accessible. He makes it so that anyone can feel comfortable doing it. Now, I'm going to tell you one of the reasons why I think the Lord's Prayer is so powerful, especially for people who are going through kind of the dark night of the soul of their prayer experience.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into a number of theologians like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Karl Barth, N.T. Wright, and they made this really fascinating statement. They said, I think I get this mostly from Bonhoeffer. If you want to be really good at any major task like music, you get a teacher, right? You get a professional who's good at it to train you. So he's saying, why wouldn't we do that with prayer? So Eugene Peterson refers to the psalmists as the prayer masters.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I love that. He says, you know, prayer is actually an art. Yes, anyone can do it, right? But with anything in life, you want to study with the master. So in my book, I use an analogy of a greeting card. Let's say it's Valentine's Day, right? You want to take your sweetheart out for dinner. You want to get them chocolates, flowers, fair trade coffee, whatever it is. And then you give them a nice card. Why is it that we buy a card with like a John Donne poem on it for our sweetheart?
Right.
When perhaps we think, I should be writing a personal statement. Well, actually, the beauty is, AJ, you can do both.
Yes.
On the outside of the card is the beautiful poem, right? By a professional who's really good at it. And the reason we choose that, at least in theory, is with their expertise, they're able to express something that I can't express with my limited experience and gifting. But then you open it up and you write, you're like, hey, honey bunny, boo, I love you so much. Never leave me. You know, something like that, right? You write your own thing in there. So I call praying the Lord's Prayer, I call it prayer duet, a prayer duet. Because you're praying with the prayer master, who is Jesus. This is actually the reason why the Lord's Prayer is so famous, because Jesus actually told us how to pray.
Yes.
But you don't stop there, because God does want to hear from you, but you're learning to align yourself with Jesus's own heart of prayer. One of the things that Karl Barth talks about, which I think is huge, is he says, when you pray the Lord's Prayer, this has transformed how I pray. When you pray the Lord's Prayer, you're not just repeating the words of Jesus, you're actually praying through Jesus.
Yes, yes.
I call this vicarious Christology.
Mm.
Vicarious meaning Jesus is a channel or a portal to connect you to God. So when you say our Father, you're actually praying to Jesus' Father, but Jesus' sonship allows you to talk to Abba, Father. So the amazing thing when we pray the Lord's Prayer, AJ, is you're not alone when you're praying to God. You're actually praying not only with, this is so powerful, you're not just praying with Jesus, you're praying through Jesus.
Yes.
How amazing is that?
It's revolutionary. I'm curious, Nijé, if we actually saw, let me do a thought experiment. Let's say Jesus came and lived in, for some odd reason, Jesus came and lived in Portland, Oregon, and in the year 2024. The incarnation happened in the year 2024 for some odd reason.
Yeah.
And we had the opportunity to like live right down the street from Jesus's little cottage or wherever. He probably wouldn't have a house.
One of those tiny homes.
And we had the chance to like watch him like live his life. What do you think? Put yourself in at least as a historian, a New Testament guy in the normal world kind of that we live in now, the current world that we live in. Like, what would Jesus's actual prayer life had looked like? Mm. Like, what would he do with his day?
Right.
I mean, I'm just curious. Would he start the day? Certainly, right in the first century, how many times a day would a Jew pray the Great Shema? Was it two or three times a day?
Some sorts say three times a day.
Three times a day. Yeah. Maybe the better question would be, like in the ancient world, like would he have started his day with prayer? Would he have ended his day with prayer? Like, what would have structured his actual prayer life?
Yeah, he was a good Jewish person, so he's going to follow a lot of the expectations and habits because he learned it from his parents, his grandparents, his uncles and aunts. So we know he went to synagogue. We know he read from the scriptures like he does when he reads from Isaiah. We know that he prays, but he also has these overnight vigils, right, of prayer. We know that when he's in the garden, he's not just phoning it in. He's praying so hard. He's sweating drops of blood.
Yep.
Right? So I think what we learn about Jesus from his prayer life is you know, you and I, when we're talking on the phone or even on the podcast, our connection is not strong sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
our internet connection. And so there's crackling, the equivalent of static. Yes. And sometimes we lose connection, right? Jesus has this perfect, crystal clear, high definition connection to God, the Father. There's no crackling. There's no, I can't hear you anymore. You know, I think of the old Verizon commercials, can you hear me now? Jesus never once said, can you hear me now? To God the Father. So I have trouble not being shaped by the TV show The Chosen, so maybe I shouldn't watch it, because it's now, right. when I picture Jesus, I picture Jeremy Rumi. So for better or for worse, who's a handsome guy, by the way. Okay, his prayer life, I think number one, constant communion with God. Constant communion with God. Number two, friendship and affection with God. Like, I don't know. We've talked about before daddy issues on this podcast. And for better or for worse, our relationship with God is going to be shaped by our relationship with our human parents, especially our fathers.
Yeah.
And my relationship with my father, I love my father. Hi, Dad, if you're listening. Growing up, I think I felt this constant desire to please him and do him proud, which led to some anxiety and stress. Right? I wouldn't use the word friendship for that relationship. I think now it's more like friendship. And we, you know, we laugh and we share more openly now than we did back then. I think because I'm an adult, because I have kids. But I would say that the kind of spirit of Jesus' relationship with the Father is one of friendship, warmth, affection, openness. Look at John 17, where he's praying the high priestly prayer. He's almost talking back to God, saying, hey, God, you need to do these things because I promised these disciples these things would happen. He's respectful, but he's kind of like convincing the Father, right, of, hey, we have this communion thing. We're going to have it with them, so purify them and keep them safe and this and that. This is also interesting, AJ. One of my professors in the seminary pointed this out to me. When Jesus heals, he doesn't use magic spells. In the ancient world, if you wanted to cure somebody, you would coerce the divine.
Interesting.
Using a spell or an amulet or a magical object or even a threat or a curse. And Jesus, it's really, my professor said, I don't know if this is true, but I want to believe it's true. Only a handful of times do the Gospels record Aramaic words of Jesus. Normally just Greek. We don't know what Aramaic words Jesus used. But when he's healing the girl, the young girl, the Gospels tell us Jesus says, Talitha kum. Which means get up, little girl. And one of my professors asked the question, do you know why why the gospel writer shows the Aramaic? Why? To show that he didn't use a spell, he used regular words. I think that's powerful because we don't have to twist God's arm to get grace from God.
Yep.
So when you ask about, okay, what would Jesus do? How would Jesus behave? I don't know if you have these people in your life, you know, really powerful, important people, you don't want to bother them. You don't want to call in too many favors. You know, I have a few people like that where I'm like, okay, I get like one favor a year from this person. Like, I can't just go back to that well every week. But Jesus has this with a father where check in. You know, my kids will check in with me.
Yep.
And I'm bothered by some people, but I'm always on the lookout whether my kids are texting me or not. Right. I think I don't know exactly what he would do, but I think that idea of constant communication that's warm and close and intimate and grace filled is meant to be a model for us.
Yeah. I mean, that reframes, again, if that professor of yours was right or wrong, I'm just going to say he was right. That reframes the entire model of prayer many of us have, which is, we have this list of internal assumptions that have been placed in us that God hears us because we repent enough, or God hears us because, hey, I wrote a big check to church last week and now, you know, I've really got God's ear now. So I guess I've never thought about a coercive prayer life where I'm sort of seeking to offer God my indulgences, so finally He'll hear me. And the way of Jesus doesn't permit for spells. We are not allowed to use spells before God. All we have is the love of the Father, and that's what we get to rely on with all constancy, with a life of sort of constant, fervent hunger. I loved your image of the birthday card. And I think of when I was in elementary school, do you remember when they would give us our textbooks and you would get to put on the paper outside of the textbook so you could draw on it. So
the
you'd
brown
get the
paper.
Yeah, the gross brown paper, and you'd write all sorts of obscenities on it secretly, backwards and whatnot.
Nope.
Some of us would, but not you and me. And you would have the sort of, you'd have the text, but then you get to personalize the text.
Yeah.
And I guess in a way, seeing the Lord's Prayer in light of what Jesus is doing here is that we have the bones, we have the structure, but there's also room in the midst of that structure to draw in and to put on that which is us, our own personality. And it's not just that we pray only the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer becomes our model, our bones, our foundation. But we also get to write the personal stuff into it as well. I have one more question for you, Nijay.
Yeah.
If Jesus came into most of our, if Jesus entered most of our communities of faith that are like churches, what do you think Jesus would say about the way Americans pray?
Oh boy. You know, the statistics on how much prayer is in a church service are really discouraging. I mean, it's in many cases, it's less than a minute of prayer. If you count, assuming you're counting what we think of as prayer versus, you know, the worship as prayer and things like that. I think Jesus would walk into a church, sit there, you know, for an hour and a half. And then if you were to interview him, he'd say, that was nice, but they weren't actually there for God. They weren't actually there to honor God. I was talking with somebody recently about what church is for. Why do we even go to church? And there's been a lot of helpful critiques of the modern church versus the ancient church that often were there to get stuff done, right? Run a Bible study or give a teaching. And it's very productive and industrial. And I was thinking about what the early Christians were doing and how they perceived of what they were doing. I was also watching the Golden Globes. And I thought about the idea of like a lifetime achievement award. Like, how special is it to present to somebody a lifetime achievement award? And what we're saying when we come together to celebrate somebody. And I thought, what if Christians viewed every Sunday as a lifetime achievement award for Jesus Christ? Now, think about that. Like, you sit there and you think, like, when you're in a, you think, this is the best of us. This person is the best of us. This person deserves my cheering.
Yeah.
This, I want to be like this person.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of saying like, I didn't get much out of the teaching. I didn't like the worship music. And I also complain about stuff at church. So don't, just hear me that. Yeah. I want church to be excellent. But what if you're actually there to give a lifetime achievement award to Jesus Christ every Sunday? That's why you show up. Like, imagine we all get in tuxedos, right? We get limos spiritually. And every Sunday, it's like, why are you going to church? Jesus is getting another lifetime achievement award. Jesus is getting another lifetime achievement award. I think Jesus would say, you guys have created a really nice club and you got some really interesting things going on. But I just don't get the sense that people are here to actually worship God.
I hope nobody hears that as critique them. I think that's me, man. I am. that's a constant deal for me. I go for alternative things all the time and need to be reminded of the centrality of the triune God in these in our gatherings together. Yeah.
I don't want to make it all bad, but I do get frustrated with the emphasis being on how good was the sermon, how good was the music.
Yeah.
I know that as a former worship leader, I know that as an occasional preacher, you know that as a longtime pastor, a lot of good things happen at church, but I think you and I were just talking briefly over text about a recent podcast episode with John Mark Comer. I don't know John Mark very well, but I really love this episode. And you can mention the podcast name because I forget it. And he'd said something to the effect of, churches are really great at getting people involved in Christianity, but they're not, most churches don't do a great job of getting people to go deeper in their spirituality with Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be a really basic way of getting into his critique. And I think Jesus would notice that. I think he'd say, you know this church really well, but how well do you know me? And I think that's what happens in prayer.
So, Nijay, we're going to walk through the Lord's Prayer. This is kind of the preamble, the kind of intro, but in our next episode, we're going to start walking through it. And the hope is that as we do so, we can attempt to maybe remedy what you're talking about here, which is take more seriously the way in which Jesus invites us to go deep into the love of God. Thanks for the intro. This is really great. I took some great notes, and I certainly know that our listeners hopefully did too. So thank you, Nijay, for your research, and we got some good stuff ahead of us.
I'm excited to dive in.